Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now we return to Vocal Point, our guest, David Barton, and it's a privilege to have him on. David wrote a book called The Jefferson Lies. His website is wallbuilders.org. What we want to do right now in this particular segment is to focus on the issue of the separation of church and state. A lot of people are under the mistaken notion that that phrase comes from the Constitution, but actually it comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1802. And yet, what's happening today, we seem to be losing our freedom in the name of the separation of church and state, and it's not even a proper reading of that letter itself from Thomas Jefferson in the current interpretation. David Barton, welcome to the program. You can say all these things better than me, but thank you so much for joining us again.
Hey, Jerry. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me, bro.
Sure. Okay. Why is it that we go from Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, which are the words of the Constitution, the First Amendment, how is it that we go from that to there shall be this strict wall of separation between church and state?
Yeah, let me go from the Jefferson perspective first, and let me back up a little bit, because Jefferson is the guy who really popularized the phrase, at least that's what the court uses as his phrase. But the phrase did not originate with Jefferson, not by a long shot. And Jefferson, in his extensive library, had the writings of a couple of significant ministers, John Wise and Joseph Priestley. And both of them did a book on the history of Christianity, or actually, as Priestley said, the history of the corruptions of Christianity. And those two guys broke the history of Christianity at that point, nearly 1,800 years, into three major categories. They had the first period they called the period of purity. The second period was the period of apostasy. And the third period they called the period of reformation. And in each of those three periods, they looked at how church and state relations worked in that point in time. And so as they go back, they establish that Jesus, well, God first and Jesus second, created a voluntary religion. You could make your choice. If you made bad choices, you'd pay for it. But Adam and Eve had a choice. They made a bad choice. They paid for it. We love to hang Joshua 24:15 on our refrigerators as Christians. As for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord. But that verse, Joshua says, okay, guys, you got a choice here. You can go back to the Egyptians and serve the God of the Egyptians, from whose land you left. We're going into the land of the Canaanites and Amorites, and you can serve their gods, in whose land we're going. As for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord. And so you get a free choice, and you make a bad choice, you pay for it. The same with Elijah. He takes on the prophets of Baal. He says, hey, you guys, make sure you pray all you want to. Take all the time you want. Just make sure I get my shot, the God that answered by fire. That's the real God. So all through the Bible, you have non-coercive religion. It allows religious conscience, and it allows free choice of religion. So that's the way the Bible established it. Jesus comes along. He does his teachings. And for the next 300 years, everybody followed the teachings of Jesus. Religion was voluntary. You could choose Christianity or not. It was your choice. No coercion. You got a right of conscience. 391 A.D. starts the second period. Emperor Theodosius comes in. He's the emperor. He says, I'm now a Christian. By the way, everybody in the world is going to become a Christian, or I'm going to kill you. So for the first time, church and state are no longer separated, because in the Bible, it started with God establishing his nation. Now, here's the way it works. Moses, you're over the civil stuff, and Aaron, you're over the spiritual stuff. Well, that's the institutions of church and state, and God did not want them run by the same person. God was involved in everything. He was never cut out of any of it, but those two institutions had different leaders over them. And so Theodosius now comes in and says, I'm going to be head of the church. I'll tell you the doctrines. I'll tell you what happens. And so at that time, for the first time in history, you have the state-established church. That's where we move from the period of purity, the way we did it God's way, into the period of apostasy. And for the next 1,000 years, that's where you have all the atrocities committed in the name of Christianity. You have Henry VIII of England, who says, hey, church is not agreeing with my view. I'll start my own church. And so you have the Anglican church. He gave himself a divorce, which Pope wasn't given. And now you've got the state establishing doctrines, enforcing doctrines, etc. William Penn comes along. He doesn't intend the right denomination. They throw him in jail. He has a trial. The Pilgrims come along. They don't intend the right denomination. They get fined every Sunday. They're persecuted. So that's the period of apostasy. Then the Bible comes back into play again, the period of Reformation. And at that point in time, starting in Germany and Austria and other places, we start going back to having a separate leader over church and state. So that's the way Jefferson has seen it. That's the way his books had taught him. That's the way it was viewed by the church at the time. That's the way other preachers preached about it. So when he says separation of church and state, what he said is we don't want the government telling you what religious practices you can or can't have, because then you lose freedom of conscience, you lose religious toleration, you lose religious choice.
All right, you said Joseph Priestley, Priestly, right? And he is was a Unitarian minister who left England because he felt persecuted, and he went to the Philadelphia area. But now it's important, I think, for you to clarify in a moment. Unitarianism of that day was not the same as the Unitarianism of today. Yeah, it was more liberal than Orthodox Christianity, but not apostate, essentially, in all cases. But who was the other fellow you mentioned? Wise.
John Wise. John Wise actually is...
W-I-S-E?
W-I-S-E. He was a minister in Ipswich, Massachusetts in the 1680s. He is considered the most one of the six most influential factors in the American founding. Because he did some sermons, and for example, we'll find that by 1680, John Wise had preached that all men are created equal and they're endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. He preached that when you look at the different forms of government, what God prefers is the consent of the governed. And he preached that when you look at taxation in the Bible, one thing is clear, that taxation without representation is tyranny. Now, all of those were preached in the 1680s. In 1772, Sam Adams, John Hancock, James Otis, the Sons of Liberty, took his sermons and reprinted them and distributed them all over America as part of the committees of correspondence.
Did John Wise also preach that Jesus Christ was the Son of God? He died for sinners. He rose from the dead. The Bible's God's word.
He was hardcore Orthodox. I mean, there is no question of orthodoxy. He comports completely to what we would consider to be Orthodox Christianity. And so he is a hardcore Jesus guy. And so he has that. And so those books come out. And then the Declaration, interestingly enough, has all these clips out of Wise's sermons. But Wise's book was in Thomas Jefferson's library. And he's read this as part of the Sons of Liberty. So, but that's also the same John Wise that says, let's look at the history of Christianity. And John Wise is the one who very clearly divides it into three sections, and he talks about religious conscience, religious toleration, and freedom of religious choice. And so Wise is really more than Priestley is the one who really laid this out. Now, Priestley came in with his history of the corruptions of Christianity, and as you said, Barry, it's exactly right. The Unitarians in that day are liberal for that day. But man, you look where they are today. There's no comparison. Unitarians started changing really about 1789. That's after the time we're talking about at the founding era, the founding documents. Jefferson is doing his stuff prior to that. And so we're protecting religious liberty, liberty of conscience, et cetera, by then. But then you have 1819 is where Channing comes in, William Ellery Channing, and he starts the American Unitarian Association, and by 1839, they go transcendental with Ralph Waldo Emerson, and that's where all roads lead to heaven, whatever you believe is fine, et cetera. But back at the time of Jefferson, Unitarians...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I want you finish the sentence. Finish the sentence. At the time of Jefferson...
As you go back to the time of Jefferson, at that time, they were still pretty close to what we would accept is generally Orthodox. They had some things that we would object to, but I mean, their position on knowing the scriptures, on Jesus being the Son of God, on salvation coming through Jesus, which, you know, this is a hard one to explain. They didn't really think that Jesus was divine, but they thought that salvation came through Jesus and he was the Son of God. And their argument was, well, I mean, if Jesus is God, then who talked to Jesus when he got baptized? He clearly isn't God because somebody talked to him out of heaven. And, you know, those are nuances we don't get into today, but their position was that Jesus is still the Savior and salvation comes through him. They just questioned whether he was completely divine in the same way God was and whether the three were one. So that was Unitarianism in Jefferson's day. And these are the guys that specifically went after the atheists. They went after those who attacked Christianity. They were some of the biggest defenders of Christianity against Europe, European attacks and the French attacks and the secular attacks. They also became some of the biggest abolitionists because of what the Bible taught about all men are created equal. So they're really not at all what we think of with Unitarians today, which Unitarians today don't think Jesus is divine by a long shot. They don't believe in the scriptures. They don't believe they're inspired or anything else. And that's just, it's such apples and oranges when you look at Unitarians in Jefferson's day and Unitarians today.
I was just going to add that actually in one of the sermons of Channing that I found in the Annals of America, which, by the way, is a wonderful series of encyclopedias put together by the Encyclopedia Britannica in the 1970s, and they had it in the sermon from Channing about 1800 in that area, where he was basically arguing it is because of the Bible we do not believe in the Trinity. In other words, his authority was the Bible. It was just a different interpretation. Now, I disagree with him. I am absolutely in agreement with Athanasius, with the belief in the Trinity and so forth. But it's not the same, as you say, the Unitarianism of today. In fact, I remember seeing a study where it showed around today, currently, or just a couple of years ago, where it said something like only 1 out of 5 Unitarians identify themselves as Christians today.
Yeah.
And whereas the in the early days they did. And in fact, Jefferson even says, I am a Christian in the most complete sense. Now, you know, there was a lot of weird stuff Jefferson believed in private near the end of his life, but nonetheless, regardless of that, and regardless of where he stood theologically, did Jefferson believe in the separation of God and state? Did Jefferson believe in what groups like the ACLU and their ilk are doing today in America, where, you know, they're working for a naked public square?
See, what's interesting is he did not believe any of the secularization aspect. He was adamantly opposed to that. He did believe that Congress should be limited. So notice the way the First Amendment reads. The only prohibition is on Congress doing something. It's not on the people. It says Congress shall make no law respecting the status of religion. Congress can't say we're all going to be Anglicans or Baptists or Methodists or Quakers or whatever. And it says in Congress, it says Congress shall make no law respecting the status of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That is, Congress, the government, can't stop your religious exercise. So the only prohibition is against Congress doing something. No. It's against students and God at graduation. Wait a minute. How do you read the First Amendment to say that a student can't say God? How is that the same as Congress making a law, a student saying God? And how is Congress making a law the same as a nativity scene being put up in a city park? And how is Congress making a law the same thing as pastors saying that I don't want to perform a homosexual wedding? See, all of this is now being done under separation church and state.
Mm-hmm.
And when you read the actual wording, it's there. But your question was about Jefferson. And when we go to Jefferson, I don't even have to ask what he thought about separation church and state. I can say your actions define your words. You said separation church and state. You said that Congress can't stop it. And by the way, when he wrote that letter, it was because he has received the letter from Jeremiah Dodge and others in Connecticut, said, hey, we're really scared the government's going to try to coerce us to do some things, and the government's going to stop our religious expressions the way we do it up here as Baptists in Connecticut. And he said, don't worry about it. That's what the First Amendment exists for. Congress will never stop your religious expressions unless you do ill to your neighbor, was the phrase he used. Unless your religious expressions say we're doing human sacrifice or we believe to kill our parents, or he said, we'll stop you then. But outside of that, if you're not doing ill to your neighbor, if you don't work ill to your neighbor, then we're not going to stop it. So that's why Jefferson goes in and he helps facilitate the church in the Capitol. That happened when he was the leader of the Senate, and the Senate and the House agreed that they would give their chaplains to have services. And so for his entire 8 years as president and for the last 3 months as vice president, Thomas Jefferson attended church every Sunday at the Capitol. He actually invited ministers to preach there. They gave him a special seat there at the Capitol. And so
didn't that violate the separation of church and state?
It does today, but not the way that he explained it. And that's why it's so key to understand what John Wise and what Priestley believed and what Jefferson read. And then when he read, and see, it's also clear, too, that it isn't what he believed. When you read the letter he wrote to the Danbury Baptist, you read that, but also read the letter they wrote to him.
Yeah.
And so when you read that letter from November the 7th of 1801 from the Danbury Baptist, and you see what they were concerned about, and then you read his letter. Now, here's the other part.
Okay, we have only 20 seconds. Go ahead.
In 1947, for the first time, they did not quote Jefferson's full letter, only 8 words from it. Every court before that quoted Jefferson's full letter, and it was a no-brainer that Jefferson, what he's stopping is the government coercing religion. Since 1947, we think what he's stopping is religious expressions, exactly the opposite of what he intended.
David Barton, wallbuilders.org. Again, the name of his book is The Jefferson Lies. Thanks so much for joining us. Let's have you back on, and we'll talk some of the other issues brought up in your important book. Thank you.
Bless you, bro. Good to be with you.
You too. God bless. Bye-bye.